Chapter 15. Religion as an Original Sin. There are indeed several ways in which religion is not just amoral but positively immoral. And these faults and crimes are not to be found in the behaviour of its adherents, which can sometimes be exemplary, but in its original precepts. These include presenting a false picture of the world to the innocent and the credulous, the doctrine of blood sacrifice, the doctrine of atonement, the doctrine of eternal reward and or punishment, the imposition of impossible tasks and rules. The first point has already been covered. All the creation myths of all peoples have long been known to be false, and have fairly recently been replaced by infinitely superior and more magnificent explanations. To its list of apologies, religion should simply add an apology for foisting man-made parchments and folk myths upon the unsuspecting, and for taking so long to concede that this had been done. One senses a reluctance to make this admission, since it might tend to explode the whole religious worldview, but the longer it is delayed, the more heinous the denial will become. Blood sacrifice. Before monotheism arose, the altars of primitive society reeked of blood, much of it human and some of it infant. The thirst for this, at least in animal form, is still with us. Pious Jews are at this moment trying to breed the spotlessly pure red heifer, mentioned in the Book of Numbers, chapter 19, which, if slaughtered again according to the exact and meticulous ritual, will bring about the return of animal sacrifices in the Third Temple, and hasten the end of time and the coming of the Messiah. This may appear merely absurd, but a team of like-minded Christian maniac farmers are attempting, as I write, to help their co-fundamentalists by employing special breeding techniques, borrowed or stolen from modern science, to produce a perfect red Angus beast in Nebraska. Meanwhile, in Israel, the Jewish biblical fanatics are also trying to raise a human child in a pure bubble, free from contamination, who will, at the attainment of the right age, be privileged to cut that heifer's throat. Ideally, this should be done on the Temple Mount, awkwardly the site of the Muslim holy places, but nonetheless the very spot where Abraham is alleged to have drawn the knife over the live body of his own child. Other sacramental guttings and throat cuttings, particularly of lambs, occur every year in the Christian and Muslim world, either to celebrate Easter or the Feast of Eid. The latter, which honours Abraham's willingness to make a human sacrifice of his son, is common to all three monotheisms and descends from their primitive ancestors. There is no softening the plain meaning of this frightful story. The prelude involves a series of vilenesses and delusions, from the seduction of Lot by both his daughters, to the marriage of Abraham to his stepsister, the birth of Isaac to Sarah when Abraham was 100 years old, and many other credible and incredible rustic crimes and misdemeanours. Perhaps afflicted by a poor conscience, but at any rate believing himself commanded by God, Abraham agreed to murder his son. He prepared the kindling, laid the tied-up boy upon it, thus showing that he knew the procedure, and took up the knife in order to kill the child like an animal. At the last available moment his hand was stayed, not by God, as it happens, but by an angel, and he was praised from the clouds for showing his sturdy willingness to murder an innocent in expiation of his own crimes. As a reward for his fealty, he was promised a large and long posterity. Not long after this, though the Genesis narrative is not very well illustrated in point of time, his wife Sarah expired at the age of 127, and her dutiful husband found her a place of burial in a cave in the town of Hebron. Having outlived her by attaining the fine old age of 175, and having fathered six more children meanwhile, Abraham was eventually buried in the same cave. To this day, religious people kill each other and kill each other's children for the right to exclusive property in this unidentifiable and unlocatable hole in a hill. There was a terrible massacre of Jewish residents of Hebron during the Arab Revolt of 1929, when 67 Jews were slaughtered. Many of these were Lubavitchers, who regard all non-Jews as racially inferior, and who had moved to Hebron because they believed the Genesis myth, but this does not excuse the pogrom. Remaining outside the border of Israel until 1967, the town was captured that year with much fanfare by Israeli forces and became part of the occupied West Bank. Jewish settlers began to return under the leadership of a particularly violent and obnoxious rabbi named Moshe Levinger, and to build an armed settlement named Kiryat Arba above the town, as well as some smaller settlements within it. The Muslims among the mainly Arab inhabitants continued to claim that the praiseworthy Abraham indeed had been willing to murder his son, but only for their religion and not for the Jews. This is what submission means. When I visited the place, I found that the supposed Cave of the Patriarchs, or Cave of Machpelah, had separate entrances and separate places of worship for the two warring claimants to the right to celebrate this atrocity in their own names. A short while before I arrived, another atrocity had occurred. An Israeli zealot named Dr. Baruch Goldstein had come to the cave and, unslinging the automatic weapon that he was allowed to carry, discharged it into the Muslim congregation. He killed 27 worshippers and injured countless others before being overwhelmed and beaten to death. It turned out that many people already knew that Dr. Goldstein was dangerous. While serving as a physician in the Israeli army, he had announced that he would not treat non-Jewish patients, such as Israeli Arabs, especially on the Sabbath. As it happens, he was obeying rabbinic law in declining to do this, as many Israeli religious courts have confirmed. So an easy way to spot an inhumane killer was to notice that he was guided by a sincere and literal observance of the divine instruction. Shrines in his name have been set up by the more doggedly observant Jews ever since, and of those rabbis who condemned his action, not all did so in unequivocal terms. The curse of Abraham continues to poison Hebron, but the religious warrant for blood sacrifice poisons our entire civilization. Atonement. Previous sacrifices of humans, such as the Aztec and other ceremonies from which we recoil, were common in the ancient world and took the form of propitiatory murder. An offering of a virgin or an infant or a prisoner was assumed to appease the gods. Once again, not a very good advertisement for the moral properties of religion. Martyrdom, or a deliberate sacrifice of oneself, can be viewed in a slightly different light, though when practiced by the Hindus in the form of sati, or the strongly suggested suicide of widows, it was put down by the British in India for imperial as much as for Christian reasons. Those martyrs who wish to kill others as well as themselves in an act of religious exaltation are viewed more differently still. Islam is ostensibly opposed to suicide per se, but cannot seem to decide whether to condemn or recommend the act of such a bold shaheed. However, the idea of a vicarious atonement, of the sort that so much troubled even C.S. Lewis, is a further refinement of the ancient superstition. Once again we have a father demonstrating love by subjecting a son to death by torture, but this time the father is not trying to impress God. He is God, and he's trying to impress humans. Ask yourself the question, how moral is the following? I am told of a human sacrifice that took place 2,000 years ago, without my wishing it, and in circumstances so ghastly that, had I been present and in possession of any influence, I would have been duty-bound to try and stop it. In consequence of this murder, my own manifold sins are forgiven me, and I may hope to enjoy everlasting life. Let us just for now overlook all the contradictions between the tellers of the original story and assume that it is basically true. What are the further implications? They are not as reassuring as they look at first sight. For a start, and in order to gain the benefit of this wondrous offer, I have to accept that I am responsible for the flogging and mocking and crucifixion, in which I had no say and no part, and agree that every time I decline this responsibility, or that I sin in word or deed, I am intensifying the agony of it. Furthermore, I am required to believe that the agony was necessary in order to compensate for an earlier crime in which I also had no part, the sin of Adam. It is useless to object that Adam seems to have been created with insatiable discontent and curiosity, and then forbidden to slake it. All this was settled long before even Jesus himself was born. Thus my own guilt in the matter is deemed original and inescapable. However, I am still granted free will with which to reject the offer of vicarious redemption. Should I exercise this choice, however, I face an eternity of torture much more awful than anything endured at Calvary, or anything threatened to those who first heard the Ten Commandments. The tale is made no easier to follow by the necessary realization that Jesus both wished and needed to die and came to Jerusalem at Passover in order to do so, and that all who took part in his murder were unknowingly doing God's will and fulfilling ancient prophecies. Absent the Gnostic version, this makes it hopelessly odd that Judas, who allegedly performed the strangely redundant act of identifying a very well-known preacher to those who had been hunting for him, should suffer such opprobrium. Without him, there could have been no Good Friday, as the Christians naively call it, even when they are not in a vengeful mood. There is a charge found in only one of the four Gospels that the Jews who condemned Jesus asked for his blood to be on their heads for future generations. This is not a problem that concerns only the Jews, or those Catholics who are worried by the history of Christian antisemitism. Suppose that the Jewish Sanhedrin had in fact made such a call, as Maimonides thought they had and should have. How could that call possibly be binding upon successor generations? Remember that the Vatican did not assert that it was some Jews who had killed Christ. It asserted that it was the Jews who had ordered his death, and that the Jewish people as a whole were the bearers of a collective responsibility. It seems bizarre that the Church could not bring itself to drop the charge of generalized Jewish deicide until very recently. But the key to its reluctance is easy to find. If you once admit that the descendants of Jews are not implicated, it becomes very hard to argue that anyone else not there present was implicated either. One rent in the fabric, as usual, threatens to tear the whole thing apart, or to make it into something simply man-made and woven, like the discredited Trial of Turin. The collectivization of guilt, in short, is immoral in itself, as religion has been occasionally compelled to admit. Eternal punishment and impossible tasks. The gospel story of the Garden of Gethsemane used to absorb me very much as a child, because its break in the action and its human whimper made me wonder if some of the fantastic scenario might after all be true. Jesus asks, in effect, do I have to go through with this? It is an impressive and unforgettable question, and I long ago decided that I would cheerfully wager my own soul on the belief that the only right answer to it is no. We cannot, like fear-ridden peasants of antiquity, hope to load all our crimes onto a goat and then drive the hapless animal into the desert. Our everyday idiom is quite sound in regarding scapegoating with contempt, and religion is scapegoating writ large. I can pay your debt, my love, if you have been imprudent, and if I were a hero, like Sidney Carton in A Tale of Two Cities, I could even serve your term in prison, or take your place on the scaffold. Greater love hath no man, but I cannot absolve you of your responsibilities. It would be immoral of me to offer, and immoral of you to accept. And if the same offer is made from another time and another world, through the mediation of middlemen, and accompanied by inducements, it loses all its grandeur, and becomes debased into wish-thinking, or worse, a combination of blackmailing with bribery. The ultimate degeneration of all this into a mere bargain was made unpleasantly obvious by Blaise Pascal, whose theology is not far short of sordid. His celebrated wager puts it in hucksterish form. What have you got to lose? If you believe in God and there is a God, you win. If you believe in him and you're wrong, so what? I once read a response to this cunning piece of bet covering, which took two forms. The first was a version of Bertrand Russell's hypothetical reply to the hypothetical question, what will you say if you die and are confronted with your Maker? His response? I should say, O God, you did not give us enough evidence. My own reply? Imponderable, sir, I presume from some, if not all of your many reputations, that you might prefer honest and convinced unbelief to the hypocritical and self-interested affectation of faith, or the smoking tributes of bloody altars. But I would not count on it. Pascal reminds me of the hypocrites and frauds who abound in Talmudic Jewish rationalization. Don't do any work on the Sabbath yourself, but pay someone else to do it. You obeyed the letter of the law, who's counting? The Dalai Lama tells us that you can visit a prostitute as long as someone else pays her. Shia Muslims offer temporary marriage, selling men the permission to take a wife for an hour or two with the usual vows, and then divorce her when they're done. Half of the splendid buildings in Rome would never have been raised if the sale of indulgences had not been so profitable. St. Peter's itself was financed by a special one-time offer of that kind. The newest pope, the former Joseph Ratzinger, recently attracted Catholic youths to a festival by offering a certain remission of sin to those who attended. This pathetic moral spectacle would not be necessary if the original rules were ones that it would be possible to obey. But to the totalitarian edicts that begin with revelation from absolute authority, and that are enforced by fear, and based on a sin that had been committed long ago, are added regulations that are often immoral and impossible at the same time. The essential principle of totalitarianism is to make laws that are impossible to obey. The resulting tyranny is even more impressive if it can be enforced by a privileged caste or party, which is highly zealous in the detection of error. Most of humanity throughout its history has dwelt under a form of this stupefying dictatorship, and a large portion of it still does. Allow me to give a few examples of the rules that must, yet cannot, be followed. The commandment at Sinai which forbade people even to think about coveting goods is the first clue. It is echoed in the New Testament by the injunction which says that a man who looks upon a woman in the wrong way has actually committed adultery already. And it is almost equaled by the current Muslim and former Christian prohibition against lending out money at interest. All of these, in their different fashion, attempt to place impossible restraints on human initiative. They can only be met in one of two ways. The first is by a continual scourging and mortification of the flesh, accompanied by incessant wrestling with impure thoughts, which become actual as soon as they are named or even imagined. From this come hysterical confessions of guilt, false promises of improvement, and loud, violent denunciations of other backsliders and sinners, a spiritual police state. The second solution is organized hypocrisy, where forbidden foods are rebaptized as something else, or where a donation to the religious authorities will purchase some wiggle room, or where ostentatious orthodoxy will buy some time, or where money can be paid into one account and then paid back, with perhaps a slight percentage added, in a non-usurious manner, into another. This we might term the spiritual banana republic. Many theocracies, from medieval Rome to modern Wahhabi Saudi Arabia, have managed to be spiritual police states and spiritual banana republics at the same time. This objection applies even to some of the noblest and some of the basest rules. The order to love thy neighbour is mild and yet stern, a reminder of one's duty to others. The order to love thy neighbour as thyself is too extreme and too strenuous to be obeyed, as is the hard-to-interpret instruction to love others as I have loved you. Humans are not so constituted as to care for others as much as themselves. The thing simply cannot be done, as any intelligent creator would well understand from studying his own design. Urging humans to be superhumans, on pain of death and torture, is the urging of terrible self-abasement at their repeated and inevitable failure to keep the rules. What a grin, meanwhile, on the face of those who accept the cash donations that are made in lieu. The so-called Golden Rule, sometimes needlessly identified with a folk tale about the Babylonian Rabbi Hillel, simply enjoins us to treat others as one would wish to be treated by them. This sober and rational precept, which one can teach to any child with its innate sense of fairness, and which predates all Jesus' beatitudes and parables, is well within the compass of any atheist and does not require masochism and hysteria or sadism and hysteria when it is breached. It is gradually learned as part of the painfully slow evolution of the species, and once grasped is never forgotten. Ordinary conscience will do, without any heavenly wrath behind it. As to the basest rules, one need only consult the argument from design once more. People wish to enrich and better themselves, and though they may well lend or even give money to a friend or relative in need, and ask for nothing but its eventual return or its grateful acknowledgement, they will not advance money to perfect strangers without expecting interest. By a nice chance, cupidity and avarice are the spur to economic development. No student of the subject, from David Ricardo to Karl Marx to Adam Smith, has been unaware of this fact. It is not from the benevolence of the baker, observed Smith in his shrewd Scots manner, that we expect our daily bread, but from his self-interest in baking and selling it. In any case, one may choose to be altruistic, whatever that may mean, but by definition one may not be compelled into altruism. Perhaps we would be better mammals if we were not made this way, but surely nothing could be sillier than having a maker who then forbade the very same instinct he instilled. Free will, reply the casuists. You do not have to obey the laws against murder or theft, either. Well, one may be genetically programmed for a certain amount of aggression and hatred and greed, and yet also evolved enough to beware of following every prompting. If we gave in to our base instinct every time, civilization would have been impossible, and there would be no writing in which to continue this argument. However, there can be no question that a human being, whether standing up or lying down, finds his or her hand resting just next to the genitalia. Useful, no doubt, in warding off primeval aggressors once our ancestors decided to take the risk of going erect and exposing the viscera, this is both a privilege and a provocation denied to most quadrupeds, some of whom can compensate by getting their mouths to the same point that we can only reach with our fingers and palms. Now, who devised the rule that this easy apposition between the manual and the genital be forbidden, even as a thought? To put it more plainly, who ordered that you must touch, for other reasons having nothing to do with sex or reproduction, but also that you must not? There does not even seem to be any true scriptural authority here, yet almost all religions have made the prohibition a near absolute one. One could write an entire book that was devoted only to the grotesque history of religion and sex, and to holy dread of the procreative act and its associated impulses and necessities, from the emission of semen to the effusion of menstrual blood. But a convenient way of condensing the whole fascinating story may be to ask one single provocative question.